Well, hello everyone. I am here with another guest. It is Der Schattenmacher, who is German, but not to be confused with my previous German guests, Consequent Fry, who I had on a couple of weeks back. This is a different German man. Germany is quite a big country, so there's more than one or two Germans. Welcome, Der Schattenmacher.
Yeah, thank you for the warm welcome. There are maybe more than two Germans in Germany, but I know Consequent Fry very well, so maybe we still know each other.
Good.
All. So, I'm Der Schattenmacher, the Shadow Maker, as a direct translation would have it. And I am a YouTuber. I started out as a YouTuber with now, I think, 50 or 55,000 subscribers on YouTube. But I do more than just videos now. I give talks in Germany. I'm invested in the political scene here. I'm not a party member, but I observe the party landscape, of course, and try to steer it in the right direction. Yeah, and I think I spent the recent months also writing a little booklet of about 100 pages on the topic of anarcho-tyranny. And as fate would have it, a common friend of ours suggested that we could talk about it and related themes, given that you are concerned yourself with similar ideas in the past and have also written a little booklet, I think, about the populist delusion, and now even a second volume about a topic that I don't know.
Yeah, well, there's a follow-up called Applied Elite Theory, which is just using the tools of populist delusion or using the tools of elite theory on the current news. Anarcho-tyranny, this is a concept that comes from Samuel T. Francis. There's a whole chapter on Francis in aforementioned populist delusion. Before we get going, though, I have noticed that I have quite a following in Germany, right? Mm-hmm. Outside, obviously, all of my top views are Anglosphere, as you'd imagine, mm-hmm. right? Because, sure. England, Britain, America, Canada, and Australia, as you'd imagine, those are lots of people from those countries watch this channel. But outside of that, the number one country that watches this channel is Germany, non-English speaking country.
Yes.
And I've always found that kind of interesting, because the French scene or the Italian scene, they're completely off on their own. They don't watch me. They never really talk to anyone. But the Germans have always been kind of interested. Why do you think that is?
It's a good question. We have the same impression. I mean, we as Germans obviously have more contacts on the continent, a little more, at least towards the French scene. Some of our guys go there once or twice a year and give a speech. For the Italian scene, it's completely blacked out. We don't know what's happening there. But the impression that you're describing holds true also for me. I think Germans are still quite right-wing. We have an active right-wing scene here. And also maybe it's the consequence of having been politically been so isolated from the truth for so long that the desire to come back to some form of reality is greater here. Maybe the French people or the Italian people were more into contact with their elites or into how their political system actually functions compared to the Germans. So we have a strong desire to catch up to reality. Maybe that is the reason. And of course, we are still a big country. So, I mean, not much bigger than France or Italy, but that will contribute to these statistics too.
All right. So well, before we get into anarcho-tyranny, I'll remind people, pick up courses at the academic agency, etc. In fact, towards the end of this video, there's another course, not done by me, another course that people can do that are going to draw people's attention to. So if you watch until the end, there'll be a special message from a friend of mine on this course you can do at the University of Buckingham. So, anarcho-tyranny.
Yeah.
In a nutshell, for people who are not familiar with this concept, what is it?
Yeah, so as you said, the concept of anarcho-tyranny, the word itself, I think, originally dates back to an essay by American author Sam Francis, written in the 90s, I think, where he describes quite briefly how the United States has no problems releasing relatively heavy duty felons from federal prison due to overcrowding or some other made up reasons. But at the same time, the United States goes to great and uncompromising lengths collecting fines for speeding or for parking in the wrong places. And in recent times, also takes much heavier measures against its lawful citizenry. And that is the concept. So that usually one would not expect to encounter tyranny and anarchy at the same location, the same geographical region, and under the same political system. It's either tyranny or anarchy. Usually tyranny presupposes a very considerable level of state power and organization, and anarchy assumes the lack of exactly that. And that we can observe these two forces or these two phenomena at the same time, the same country. In France's view, and also in my view, is something new, especially to this degree, as we observe it. And that is the concept of anarcho-tyranny.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to give some real world examples, I recently found out, or recently been in the news here, that the Tory party put a cap on shoplifting. So if you went into a shop and stole £199 worth of goods, you wouldn't get prosecuted by the police, because the goods that you steal have to be over £200 for any actual action to be taken. Meanwhile, under the same government, they changed the street that I have to drive on every single day. You can imagine this big, wide street that was for decades a 40-mile-an-hour street, okay? Mm-hmm. I have to drive through this every day. There's one of those yellow cameras there, okay? They've turned it to a 20-miles-an-hour street. And if you go 22 miles an hour or 23 miles an hour through this little bit, you get 3 points on your license. And because I have to do it every single day...
It's hard, yeah.
I've been hit by that several times. So there's me paying my taxes, trying to be a good citizen... And yet I'm being needled for these little annoying fines all the time for driving 23 miles an hour on a road where there are no pedestrians, which used to be a 40-mile-an-hour road, okay? Meanwhile, you've got people literally getting away with theft from your local shop. In fact, there's been a big story here in a town not that far away from me in Richmond. At 10:30 in the morning, somebody took a sledgehammer and smashed the window of this family jeweler's that's been there for years and did a robbery in broad daylight. And people were filming it. And they, you know, it ended up online and so on. And the whole conversation has been, you know, we're kind of shocked, but we're not surprised because this is just what things are like now. And to me, that is like the definition of anarcho-tyranny. You feel like those people... The people who ripped off that jewelers are emboldened, whereas the normal people who are trying to just live their lives, be a good citizen, are constantly being barracked with annoying little things like, you know, getting fines and points on their licenses or going 22 miles an hour.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that we have exactly the same phenomenon in Germany. As I said, I give a lot of talks in Germany and I have to travel long distances for that, and yeah, I get fined almost every time. I mean, we on our highways we have speed limits of sometimes 100, sometimes 110 or 120, and they are constantly interchanged. And so you drive 120, you stay on the average, let's say, and sometimes it's also 130, and then you enter a 100 zone and you get fined for that. I mean, you get caught and fined. But these are the more harmless, let's say, 20th century phenomena of anarcho-tyranny. They are annoying, sure, but I think, especially in recent times, we have seen even much more severe cases of this anarcho-tyrannical dynamics. For example, so my booklet has 4 chapters in general introduction and then some examples and then the explanation why that is and how we could get away from this. So let me give you some of the more severe examples from the second chapter. We had a case here where 2 African migrants kicked a German native in the head, which killed him, and they got away with around 2 years, both of them. And the reasoning was the man died, but he had a pre-existing heart condition. And so it could not be ruled out that he died because of that and not because of the kicks to the head. So 2 years on probation. Not on probation, but this is close to probation, or what is still eligible to probation in Germany. And on the other hand, we had people here who received 12 years in prison for repeated Holocaust denial, 12 years. Or in Austria, we had a case for 10 years for the production of National Socialist music. I mean, this was probably violent music. Yes, I don't listen to it, but 10 years in prison. This is Gulag-style sentencing for media production. And on the other hand, we have people, killing people, other people, raping other people, and seeing prison for 2 years, 3 years at best.
And on the heart condition thing, I mean, the victim was unfortunate enough not to be called George Floyd.
Yes.
Because if you remember the details, I mean, the guy who did, I forget the cop's name now, but he's like in jail for life, basically. And yet none of these, you know, expediting circumstances were taken into consideration at all for him. But these migrants that you're talking about, well, just 2 years. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
And not only that, I mean, these are examples. We also have people here who sit several months or even years in imprisonment on remand, I think you call it, for trivial tax evasion or for planning supposed revolutions. I mean, you have a famous case here where a group of retirees, basically without any real political power, without any weapons, without preparing explosive devices, got imprisoned on remand still for revolutionizing against the Federal Republic. Of course, these are basically made up charges, but they are likely going to die in prison even before they see a judge now.
Yeah, no, I mean, in the back of my mind, I've seen images of people getting raided in Germany for essentially thought crimes or for owning the wrong book. Or how common is that? And with the rise of the AfD, has it become even more exacerbated recently?
Yes, definitely. So it hits normal people sometimes, let's say boomers who post the wrong meme on Facebook. And because this meme is a Volkswagen, so it is a crime, as it promotes crimes against humanities, let's say, they get their homes raided. But for the political active class, it's even more severe. I can say for sure, I don't know a single person in my sphere of political activists, of speech givers, YouTubers, who hadn't had contact with the police or the state in some form. Not all got their homes raided, although many did, but there is contact from the Secret Service, there is a visit by the police, there is a home raid, or home raiding, the order is a visit from the local Antifa organization, which is most of the time, at least passively, also state-backed. So I think not a single person is not coming into contact with that if they are politically active in Germany.
So it's like a kind of total anti-fascist state, if you want to put it this way, where the state is so vigilant against the threat of quote-unquote fascism that, you know, you end up with these essentially Stasi-like activities as part of daily life almost. Is that putting it too far? Or
No, it's correct. Of course, the means by which this is done, they are still somewhat soft. So we don't live in the Soviet Union under Stalinist rule where we would be just shot or end up in a gulag and then have no possibility to continue our work. So we haven't reached this degree of severity for sure. And I think there are also reasons for that. I mean, we can speak about this later. But when it comes to pure contact with the state or having to endure repercussions, I think then the rate is approximating 100%. Yeah.
Interesting. What are some other examples of anarcho-tyranny in the book?
For example, we had a nice case here. So if you are a hunter or a sport shooter, you have to go through ridiculous lengths to make sure that your weapons are not stolen. So you have to, I think, buy even several different encasings for your gun and then for the ammunition and that it is not stored together but stored separately. So you have to invest a lot of time and money to make that sure of that. Then on the other hand, we had a murderer who killed his victim cut off his with several dozen knife stabbings, and then cut off his head in an Islamic fashion and yelled some Islamic stuff. And then he was not put into prison, he was put into a psychiatry. And because he is now living in a psychiatry and not actually in a prisoner, he has certain rights. And one of these rights is to go to the cinema, for example. And then he goes with his doctor, a small woman of maybe 100 pounds, to the cinema, and he escapes. And then a great police effort has to be made to get him back. So on the other hand, we have to make sure that in this one case per year, that if a gun is stolen, the ammunition is not stolen at the same time, or at least not immediately stolen. But on the other hand, we have absolutely high-level felons who can go to the cinema and escape from there. So the difference in these different levels of severity, I think, are relatively obvious.
So let's try to get to some of the thinking behind this,
yes.
Right? Why would a modern state like the German state, or the British state, or the American one, because let's not forget Sam Francis was talking about America.
Yeah.
And it does happen, no matter what Americans say about their constitution and all that sort of stuff, pretty much all these things that have happened in America as well. What are they, like, from the point of view of power, what are they trying to achieve? What is the point of this kind of, soft tyranny on law-abiding citizens and, you know, the laxness towards scumbag criminals? Like, it's counterintuitive because it goes against the classic contract, you might say, between the government and the rulers and the ruled. You know, the rulers have got an obligation to protect the citizenry in exchange for them being in power. That's always been, that was the classic contract between any king and his people. So they violate this. What is the purpose of it?
Yeah. So coming back to Sam Francis also wrote a book, a much longer one, which was posthumously published under the title of Leviathan and Its Enemies, where he attempts to update James Burnham's theory of managerialism from the 40s to the political reality of the late 20th and early 21st century. And I thought it would be a good idea to combine those two concepts, anarcho-tyranny and managerialism, to explain the first by the latter in the context of the most recent past. I think this is the only chance to understand it, as you said, because otherwise it would be just paradoxically. So the main question was, for me, why is this happening? So I asked myself the same. Is this an accident, or is it engineered to somebody's advantage? And with the help of Francis' very elucidating book, I think, I could deliver an approximate answer to that question. And I think, yes, it is engineered, or at least it is not prohibited to the advantage of somebody. And that somebody is, in Francis' opinion and in mine, the managerial class. The managerial class profits from the conditions of anarcho-tyranny, I think, in two ways. First, it weakens the one class that is still threatening its hold on power. The white, conservative, or right-wing, mostly middle and working class indigenous people of Europe. They neither want or need such heavy managerialism as we have it, and so they are natural enemies of the regime. Francis also describes the history of them, how they first were the bourgeois peoples, with the high money power in the 19th century, who was the enemy of the managerial class, and then they got away, and then we have the post-bourgeois proletariat, which is basically the people that I just described. So they are still the only people most powerful enough and competent enough to stop the managerial regime and its grasp on power. So they don't like it, and yeah, the middle class is the main target of the anarchy part. Even if laws are not written with an overt class or racial bias, especially in Germany, they are constructed, or they are evolved in a way that benefits violent criminals, which are most often not middle class Germans, or they foster general lawlessness, shamelessness, rootlessness, and all these things threaten the communities and security and the social cohesion of the conservative white people, who are the natural enemies of the managerial class. So that is the the first point and the second.
Sorry to interrupt here. I think it's worth mentioning how this stuff is so visible in everyday life now. Okay, I didn't mention I listen to this shitlib radio station in my car, LBC. Okay, every day they have a call in. Right. I mean, this one about the burglary of Mitch Mund is one of them, right? Oh, how have we come to this point? How are people being so brazen? Okay. Or another call in they had recently is, we're having a problem on trains where people on trains can't behave. They can't be quiet in the quiet zone. Should we have women-only carriages? Should we ban children from different things? Okay. And the elephant in every single room when they have these conversations is, because, you know, all these people, how have things changed? How have we got to this point? Why aren't people following the rules anymore? How are people being so brazen? And, you know, I'm listening there and screaming, like, you know, in my head, I'm thinking, it's obvious why this has happened. Lots of the people who are involved in these things aren't from this country. It's so obvious that, you know, the impact, like, is coming from, you know, in a way the pets of the regime, but we're not allowed to talk about that. We're not allowed to talk about the actual cause of the issue. And so instead what happens is the rules have to be changed for everyone. And then you end up with things like women only carriages or banning children from this or that, or you understand what I mean, right? The solution is always more managerial power, because the tyranny part won't let you talk about the actual source of the issue.
Yeah, and that is certainly true. I think the other point is then also it directly benefits the regime of managers. I mean, the other point is then the chaos benefits the managerial class, because every felon you do not put in prison or you do not execute, but put into psychological therapy, you have to, you have tenfold the opportunities to expand the managerial class around it. Yeah, you need a therapist, you need guards, you need lawyers, and all of these people, all of these administrators, as Francis describes it, come into positions of power and influence. And I think, yeah, as you described, these two parts together, they all accelerate each other. So with every level you get into this game, you get one level higher in severity, because the anarchy that this is bred by the system fosters the tyranny, as you described, because you have to put the people down, and then this tyranny fosters more anarchy, and so on and so on. And so we end up in a system like now, 20 years after Francis wrote his book, which is still much more severe. It's much clearer that the phenomenons he described are coming to life.
Yeah, absolutely. What can anybody do anything about this? Because, you know, a lot of the classic answers, in a way, are already foreclosed. For example, you know, in this country, things used to function, things used to work, things used to be safe. Basically because Britain was a high trust society, and that trust had been built up through a lot of things which were informal, which were not enforced by law, which were just like, you know, trusting people to be honest and decent and morally upstanding and so on. Clearly that answer can't work in modern Britain, because the people are not morally upstanding. They cannot be trusted to do the right thing. They disregard social custom and law. They're not even aware of what the social custom and law is. So it's like you're between a rock and a hard place, because the solution is always then more managerialism. So how do we get out of this, if at all?
Well, in the short term, that is a very difficult question. I don't know exactly how to get out of this. But in the long term, I think first, this approach from the managerial state causes also problems. It's not just that the regime improves in its state of power all the time. They produce a lot of groups that are not sufficiently controllable anymore, and they cause problems. I mean, we should not forget, they don't want total tyranny and they don't want total anarchy, for reasons. I mean, total if they wanted total anarchy, they just would do nothing and we would live like in Cormac McCarthy's The Road or something. So, but we don't. And there's a clear reason for that. If you have total anarchy, then there is no place for the managerial class either. So you, in order to manage and administer something, you need a certain, still a certain level of order. If even if a low level of anarchy and chaos is good for them. So that's the first. And I think they're losing a bit the grasp on the control about that. The migrant classes that come in are not very prone to be controlled for a very long time. And even the white people resistance movement that is now sprung up all over the West, they are very hard to be manipulated by money or by the nice words that the regime used the last 20 years. I think problems are accumulating. Don't you have the same impression?
I do and I don't. I think that the regime is underestimated in how much it's willing to pull back, you know, in order to go forward. This is what I'm always talking about, containment all the time. Mm-hmm. I am also somewhat skeptical about the resistance, as you put it, the quote unquote base right wing, their resilience against money and people manipulating them and so on, I think has come into severe scrutiny in the past couple of years. So the thing I worry about is, one, people under, like, I mean, it started to happen. Keir Starmer, for example, reduced net immigration by 70% last year. Mark Carney in Canada got it down to minus numbers. That's the regime basically like, right, we need to do something because otherwise it's going to be curtains for us, okay? And then on the other hand, the opposition, in this country it's Nigel Farage, is so easily, how can I put it, like compromised, money gets in there, it's somebody else's agenda then, that they love what I call the clown show and slop and populism in general. Sloppyism, as I call it. And so in a way, people are then brought back in, either through, the system sorting it out. Okay. And a lot of people don't believe that because that they don't have great amount of trust for the center, for the neoliberal center anymore. But then they're kind of back around the back door, they're sold this hope that somebody, Nigel Farage in the case of this country, is going to come in and sort it all out. You know, we vote for this guy, it's going to be reform, and it's all made, you know, the system is working, it is listening, it is responding to us. And I think the example of what has happened in America, what has happened with this Trump presidency and MAGA and so on, which, I have a very negative view on, should be a warning for all of the other countries that, actually, like if you let this go unchecked, or if you don't point out the bad things that are happening just because you want to have hope that your country is going to be saved, it can actually unlock the door to even worse manipulations and even worse situation. And in the cold light of day, what has happened in America? I think they wasted 10 years of energy on something that's led them down the garden path. And the challenge is, I think, how do you stop this happening? Because the security state, as you mentioned at the start, are hypervigilant.
Yeah.
The security state is hypervigilant, but they also want to show the people that something is going to be done to get them to buy back in. This is their tax base at the end of the day, right? So then you get talking points and things co-opted by, it's the age-old problem of the control opposition of the people who can't be trusted. Now, I don't know the ins and outs of the AFD, but I can imagine the AFD have many, many, many similar problems to the Reform UK. You know, in this country, it's got to the farcical extent now that Farage is literally just recruiting the old Tory government, the one that got us into this mess in the first place, the one that did the Boris wave, is now literally being sold as the solution to the problem.
yeah, We have similar problems, of course, in Germany with the AfD. I think not on the same level, not to the same severity. Sure, the AfD was founded in 2013, for example, and a lot of the old conservative class from the CDU, from our classical conservatives, got over to the AfD. But this happened now 13 years ago already, and I think the flow of people from the actual now classical conservatives, supposed conservatives, that are changing to the AfD, this is almost zero. And yeah, we have Libcon boomer types in the AfD too. This is all true. We have controlled opposition there. But there are also, I think, candidates that want to go into different directions, and they even have entered positions of power. Now, what you're describing there, this try to contain the situation, of course the regime would do that. Of course, this isn't an effect that we would have to expect. The problem is, what I think they do is they always just solve half of the problem. They can never fully contain the situation. Now, for example, they can contain the Trump presidency somewhat and make sure that the basic ties to maybe Israel not broken, the basic immigration regime is not changed. Maybe that still works. But in the wake of Trump, a lot of people rose to positions of influence or notoriety that would be unthinkable, I think, 10 years ago. So there is always a big residue to the actions of the regime, and it seems to accumulate. I mean, nobody could imagine now in our spheres going back to in the headspace to the year 2015, even, because things have progressed and accelerated so much. So don't you think there's still a little ratchet effect also on our side? Because for Germany, I see this very clearly.
One of the, how can I put this? One of the kind of, I don't want to try to black pill here, but
yeah,
it's like I mean, we're actually recording this on the weekend after the Epstein files have actually been released, something that people have been talking about for years and years. All the details are out there now. All the receipts are out there. All the secrets are out there. It has been revealed. The whole system, you know, if you were a Q-tard back in the day, right? The people will be shown and all this sort of stuff. But because, as per populist delusion, all politics is about the organized minority as against the disorganized mass, it's almost like they're saying, like, look, this is who we are. It's all out there. What are you going to do about it? Or even worse, we're gonna trap you into a new... So you talked about a mental headspace, right?
Yeah.
Well, now you've been red-pilled. And now you can talk online and, you know, your red pill takes, and you can do your red pill tweets, and you can live in your red pill ecosystem.
Yes.
But in a way, you've entered like a new, this is a bizarre thing. You've entered like a new containment box, a new goldfish bowl, where it's like, well, we can see you there and you can play. I mean, my buddy Scrump calls it the based ball pit, right? You can play in there, and as long as you don't actually like threaten the system, knock yourselves out, red pill as many people as you want, because we're not going to go anywhere, and frankly you're not going to do anything about it, because if you do that, the hard security state, the army, whatever, is there for us. So what are you going to do about it? So in a way, that there's a kind of, I see the fragility you're talking about, mm-hmm. but at the same time there's this kind of like brazen element where it's like, yeah, you know, we kind of know what's happening, but we're still here. You know what I mean? And you're not going to do anything about it, are you? Have all the details. I mean, they're literally, we're literally at the point now where, you know, it's the, like people used to talk about the cabal and the satanic elite and all this sort of stuff. Now it's all out there. And it's like, yeah, we're just going to carry on as if nothing's happened. You know what I mean?
Of course that is true. And a lot of people try to cope with the situation, I think, in the wrong way. I mean, absolutely true. Still, the question is, on what time scales are we talking about? I mean, for example, the first socialist movements in Europe on a professional scale, I think they sprung up in the mid-19th century. Let's say 48, the manifesto was written, I think, in the 60s or 50s or 60s, the precursor to the German SPD, Social Democratic Party, was born. And it took them 60 or 70 years to get to a revolution in Russia and then in Germany. 60 or 70 years is a lot of time. I mean, when did our movement start? For simplicity's sake, let's say 2014 with Gamergate, or 2012 is the second Obama presidency. So these are still just 15 years. So yeah, maybe it's another 40 years that we have to endure this state. But I don't think that it can be working in the fashion that it does right now indefinitely. I think there's still too much residue accumulation, like in a cell, who can survive this for some time too, without ever changing the course, without ever changing the political system as it works right now. And that is an interesting point, I think, to talk about some adjacent topic. What will happen if the day comes? So if the security forces, for example, have to really put a foot down? Because I think this is also something so far we haven't seen. I mean, yeah, we have soft policement, so to say. Yeah, you get arrested, you get put into prison if you commit a murder or if you try to revolutionize against your own state. This is all happening. But we don't live in Nazi Germany or National Socialist Germany, and we don't live in communist Russia. So we don't have these same means. And the question is, if there ever comes to point where the regime has to employ such tactics and such strategies of such physical severity, won't it kill the mode of being, or won't it replace the current political elite class for good if they have to take this step? And is this not the reason that they are afraid of it? Because, for example, in the Soviet Union, we have seen exactly something like this. As soon as the security apparatus became too dominant, the old, softer, intellectual, more intellectual revolutionary class was eradicated. And I think even our elites have an implicit fear of that.
Yes, well, that teases up nicely for one of our later conversations about foxes and lions, class yes. ones and class two elites. Well, this has been a very interesting primer on anarcho-tyranny, Schattenmacher. Well, where can people get this little booklet of yours?
Yeah, it's published in February. It's problematically only published in German language so far. I mean, if there would be a great interest, but it's hard to find out. We would have to think about an translation into English. But for my German listeners, February this year, you can buy the book at Antaios. Yeah.
Great. And you have a YouTube channel, which I'll link in the show notes yes. as well. I'll do that little at thing. You know, you can I'll do that. I'll just remind people to pick up a course at the Academic Agency. And as I promised at the start, I'm part of something at the University of Buckingham called the Center for the Study of Heterodox Social, or the Heterodox Center for the Study of Social Sciences, or something like that. I've been a senior fellow there for a while. The man who runs it is called Eric Kaufman, and I have a little video of his I want to play here.
The ideology of our universities and many other institutions can accurately be described as woke. Woke is not an epithet, but used properly describes the dominant cultural left belief system of Western institutions. Have you ever wondered how woke came about, who believes in it, and why? Or how the culture war between woke and anti-woke forces is redefining society and politics? Well, there's good news. I've developed a 15-week online course on woke at the University of Buckingham, which is open to the global public, the first of its kind in the world. The course is not assessed, but is focused instead on deepening your understanding of woke. I offer a rigorous objective analysis of this phenomenon, similar to the way I would for fascism, communism, or any other ideology. I've studied the cultural left since the mid-1990s, and I'm ideally placed to help you understand woke. Sign up today using the attached link.
All right. So, yeah, if you're interested in that, that link is also in the show notes. Schattenmacher, I will, speaking of links, I'll send you a new link in a moment.
Yeah.
And for you watching this, get out.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, Logic, and Rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.